geometry. So we have an incoming neutron beam, and we decided that we're going to, there's of course potentially two paths for the neutron beam to come in, but we've decided, one, that we're only going to use one of them, and two, that we're going to label the paths based upon the sign of the y component of momentum. All right. So at the first blade, we have effectively a Hadamard gate that the neutron is coherently placed in a superposition over those two paths. Over between the first and second blade, there's a phase gate. And I just arbitrarily put the phase in one of the paths. Of course, there's a phase in both, but I'm going to take out the global phase. This middle blade, we're treating it as if it was a mirror. And we're looking at only those neutrons that are directed back into the interferometer and arrive at the third blade, where, of course, we have exactly the same interaction that we had at the first blade, but now, of course, there's two potential paths coming in, there's two paths going out, and we label these O and H simply for historic reasons, but of course we see that here, if I'm looking at the intensity, the number of neutrons that arrive at that detector, then the observable is the projector along zero, and here the observable is the projector along one. Okay, and I didn't tell you, but the detector here is a helium-3 detector. These are the same detectors that you see at all the border crossings now. That if you drive your car over to Buffalo, you will see these big metal squares that you have to go through. They're full of helium-3, and they're exactly to detect neutrons. And remember that if I have a neutron and helium-3, that they will helium-3 will capture the neutron. The capture cross-section is huge. It's 5,000 barns. And a barn, you'll remember, is 100 femtometers squared. So that's a huge area. And so it's very, very likely to capture a neutron. This is, of course, for thermal. We're a little bit subthermal neutrons. This process will give us a tritium and a proton and about 700 kiloelectron volts of energy. And so effectively, we just measure a charge afterwards. So it's a very easy process. So it's very efficient because the capture process is very easy. It's very efficient because the outcome is very easy to detect. Yeah.
If have an operator like PV1 over 2 into 1, I1, can it still perform the same function?
Say this again, I didn't catch it.
Like, one, the entries will be 1, I1, whether I can perform the same function like the Hadamard operator.
Oh, I mean, could I have a different version of the Hadamard, of course. This Hadamard, so, you know, if you were looking at this process with photons, then we would have different operators, right? Because we would have electromagnetic waves scattering off of this. Okay, so yes, these are the operators that are appropriate for neutrons, but in an equivalent experiment done with optics, they would be different because, of course, you pick up a phase shift of pi under the action of a mirror.
Also, probably you're also referring to the fact that the standard had a mark with a minus sign somewhere else. Don't you?
Yeah.
Had a mark, so, right?
It has it here.
Yes. Is that?
Yeah. But that's the one that I want. So, okay, so now then we can ask that we have an input set which is pure, and we can look at the output. So nothing surprising here. What did I call that? And of course, the inverses of those. And for this particular case, maybe I should get the signs right this time. We end up with that state. Now, there were a couple of questions yesterday, and I want, yeah.
The way you've written
oh,
the
thank
phase
you.
Should be.
Thank you. Yeah, that's consistent with the way I wrote the experiment. Good. There were a couple of questions after class yesterday. One of the questions was sort of a foundational question of saying, hey, why do we know that we should treat this coherently, that we don't have a neutron that goes through a blade and deterministically takes one of these two paths? And the way I want you to think about that is to think about this in terms of an experiment that you've seen before of having a photon going into a beam splitter. And if there's a promise that there's one photon coming into the beam splitter, and it's a 50-50 beam splitter, then we don't have any knowledge of which way that photon went. And so we don't have any right to treat it as other than a coherent superposition. Now, here, you know, you might worry that says, oh, well, I have a neutron coming in. It's going to interact with this blade. And it will, depending upon which path it takes, it will leave momentum in that blade, right? And you would say, ah, well, there is some demon somewhere in the world, but that information is not accessible. So we have no right to treat it as though that was something that we could make use of. Okay. You were asking about the various phase shifts. So first, of course, here we see the output state. There's only one angle. So certainly in this experiment, we don't have universal control. And we could say that we have a number of different interactions that would introduce a phase shift. Of course, the neutron has mass, the neutron has spin, and so I could have a magnetic cross-section, or I could have a gravitational shift. All of those are easy to see in neutron interferometry. They're all going to show up as a phase shift right here. And you can see what's going to happen. You say, oh, let's just take the magnetic field. I could say, oh, I'm going to take a magnetic field, and then it's the neutron, depending upon its spin states in the magnetic field, is going to be a potential change. So that potential change is going to act like an index of refraction. It's going to speed things up or slow things down. Yeah? If it happens here, well, no interest, right? Global phase. It happens here, we get a conditional phase on the path. But of course, hey, we already have that. Happens over here. Doesn't make any bloody difference, right? Because we're making a measurement there. So having those additional cross-sections, and I include them in the notes. So if you go and look in the Mathematica notebook, you'll find that stuff written out in gory detail. Doesn't give us universal control. Now, of course, there is an easy way of getting universal control. It says, let me take this blade. And now let me change the blade to a general operator. And no, actually, I want minus there. And so we have this generalized operator. You can see that if I use this, of course, I get one more phase in the problem. But I don't have control over that, right? We built the system once. We get what we get. Okay, so if I want to have universal control of neutron interferometry, we build a bigger interferometer with more paths. And we'll talk about that later on. Okay. Now, what I want to do, remember that the reason we were looking at neutron interferometry is we wanted to have a system where a physical system where the open system dynamics we could completely describe in terms of the device properties. Okay? I didn't need to include an environment. So here, I want to start talking about open system dynamics. And I want you to think about a reduced set of dynamics. So you've all heard this before from Ben, okay? But the way that we're going to think about this is I'm going to take an extension of this simple unitary dynamics. And so we're going to say that the density matrix that we get out is given by a convex sum over some classical probability distribution. Okay, so I define a classical probability distribution. And what we're saying is that each element of that distribution is going to see a different operator. This is going to be a common thing in what we're looking at with the physical systems. This is by far the dominant noise that we have in physical devices. And let's talk about where that distribution comes from. In the neutron interferometer, we have a beam of neutrons. There's actually the count rate here is really slow. 1 per second in general. The velocity of the neutrons is 2 kilometers per second. The space that we have here is 10 to 20 centimeters. The lifetime of a neutron in the interferometer is about 50 to 100 microseconds, depending upon which one we're looking at. And so we only have one neutron ever arriving in our interferometer at a time. And we ask, well, what is going to be the noise? Well, we have a beam coming into our neutron interferometer. Each neutron that comes in has the same momentum, but it doesn't have the same spatial location. And so the beam that we see coming in here is actually about 2 millimeters by 8 millimeters. And of course, it's built up over time. So in this particular case, this classical probability distribution says, hey, exactly which element of this beam did that neutron pertain to? And as it goes through, it won't surprise you, I hope, that the exact phase that it picks up at the blade or it picks up at the phase shifter is going to be very slightly different. So if I have a blade of silica, a difference in material of 10 microns is about a high phase shift. Okay, so you say, okay, I'm going to take this blade, I'm going to machine it perfectly. But if the overall width of it changes by 10 microns, we have a pi phase shift. And so we try really hard. But, you know, there are variations. There are bigger variations in these blades. So here, the distribution is a distribution over time. Each event that we see, and of course, we don't measure a separate phase for each event. We don't correlate the outcome with the events, with the location. What we do is we integrate with this helium-3 detector. And so at the end of the day, we just integrate over that distribution, which says that every neutron came in differently. If we were looking at the NMR system, then the NMR system is carried out in an ensemble. We said 10 to the 17 molecules. So we have a milliliter, a little bit less than a milliliter of fluid in the tube. And we're interacting with magnetic fields, and magnetic fields are not perfectly uniform. Okay. And of course, the molecules that are sitting on the side of the tube are different than the molecules that are sitting in the middle of the tube. They see a different magnetic field from all of the other molecules. And so again, there's a distribution. You can tie it directly back to a classical probability distribution. But it says that the unitary dynamics are slightly different in each of these. Okay, good. So this, of course, isn't a complete picture of everything that can go wrong, right? This is just one piece of it. Now let's look at what happens if rho n is not a function of z. If rho n is not a function of z, if I promise you that every neutron coming into this interferometer, regardless of where it is located in that beam, has the same momentum, okay? That's all I have to promise you. If I promise you that, then of course this is very nice because it's going to describe a completely positive dynamics. We know that the purity of the output state is only going to be reduced or unchanged from the purity of the input state. If, of course, the input state really is a function of z, okay, then all bets are off, right? Because we'll talk about that, but you can get things that look like echoes. You can have a state that when you go through a process, actually you increase the purity, things that are uncomfortable in talking about in physics, but in fact they occur. Yeah.
So z here is the z direction.
Z here is just a parameter.
Right.
Yeah, I probably should have chosen something else, but just something to index right. This probability distribution.
Yeah. That's right.
Okay. So I know that for saying that we can see funny things when the input state is a function of z is going to be somewhat uncomfortable for you. But we will come back to that, okay? And here I wanted to take this piece of it. I want to say that it's not a function of z, and we'll continue today's lecture with that piece. Okay. Now, the way that that Ben, I'm sure, asked you to look at this was in terms of Krauss operators. Okay, so then we would say, oh, well, okay. Under this condition, this is required. This is very general. This is always true. Okay? Now, I may have to put in, you know, some decoherence in here or something, but this is always true. But if this is the case, then, and only then, can I write a Krauss picture for this. And the nice thing about these Krauss operators is that there's a small number of them, right? The number is the dimension of the Hilbert space squared, right? So we say, ah, yeah. With n squared actions, I know that I can completely characterize a completely positive dynamics of a system. And further, that there's a nice prescription for finding this, so that if I know the mapping of this for every possible operator, so I can compose a superoperator. Superoperators, did he talk about those?
He just mentioned very briefly.
Okay. All right, so let's say that I have a map, and that map, you know, is fully defined over this Hilbert space. Then a nice way of looking at that map is to ask, well, how do the operators in this Hilbert space transform under the action of that map? And so I can define a new vector space, which is typically called the Liouville space, which has the dimension of the square of the Hilbert space. So if I have one spin 1/2 particle, then we know that the nice basis set is a Pauli basis, and we've got four operators that span that basis. Now then, I want to describe a map which is going to map those operators. So now I have a 4x4 space, the Liouville space, which is going to describe how each of those operators is mapped into the other one, right? And then it's very simple, right? Because you're saying, ah, all I'm going to do is take each element of the Pauli basis. I'm going to map it to the output. And I'm going to look at the coefficients in front of each element of the Pauli basis in the output state, and I'll describe the superoperator from that. Okay? So we'll, in the notes, I have some examples of this, and the code completely worked out. So then if he didn't tell you about that, he probably didn't tell you about the Choi matrix.
No, he didn't.
We'll get there. I'll keep that in mind. Okay. So here, we have this nice construct. I'll give you the tools for finding this easily. We will use it. And it has a nice requirement that those operators sum to the identity. Okay. If that's the case, everything is happy. We know that must have been true. This is not as general as that, except that it doesn't require that condition. Good. Now, why do we like the Krauss decomposition? We like the Krauss decomposition because what Choi told us is how to extract the Krauss operators in an ordered list. So not only does Choi allow us to extract the Krauss operators and to get just the dimension squared, so the smallest number possible, but he also tells us, here's an ordered list. Here's the biggest action first, and the next biggest action. And so you can look at the dynamic and say, well, what's the most important process going on? And the Krauss-Ott picture will give you that. Now, I'm going to make a simplification here that will be true for all of what we talk about. It'll be true for all of the decoherence, and it'll be true for these incoherent processes. And what I'm going to do is we're going to take these as the square root of a probability times the unitary. Now that is not, again, completely general. But there's no aspect of the physics in any of the systems I'm talking about that cannot be written in that form. Okay? And it allows for a really nice picture, right? It says, hey, here we just have some complex operator. Here I have a nice action which I know is unitary, and I can associate a probability with it. Okay, and you can see here I've got a continuous probability distribution, but I can take that continuous probability distribution and reduce it to a set of effective actions over the ensemble, the effective ensemble describing the density matrix, and I can order those actions. Okay. Now, sorry for keep referring back to Ben. This is the first year he taught, so I didn't know what he would and would not include. So I need to take a few moments and talk about different processes. So we have row in going to row out. And of course, yeah.
So the idea of the density matrix is that we have quantum probability and we also include like classical probability. So now we have also classical distribution over density matrix, which is already
so
classical distribution.
So the density matrix, thanks for the question. Let me try to do this. So the density matrix is giving us a picture of the ensemble dynamics. Okay. And you know it's going to describe how expectation values are mapped. So we want to think about it in terms of some ensemble picture. As we do that, for the physical systems we're talking about, and in fact, you could do this really quite generally, we're going to have an underlying distribution of events. And so I could think that, yes, at one particular location, right here, I could describe the process for those neutrons that enter at that location. There'll still be a lot of neutrons there. I'll still have to use a density matrix to describe the dynamics. Okay, but it'll be different than the density matrix for this location. And we wanted to keep track of that. You can see what happens. If I only look at the density matrix of the resultant process averaged over the beam, then I lose the physics, right? Because I've integrated over this knowledge, which really is there in the system. And of course, I get some effective operator, which I can't invert back to recovering the physics. And so when we make a model of the system, I want to keep these distributions in the model so that I can tie it to the physics. And then we can ask later on, can we carry out the experiment in such a way that we can recover elements of that distribution? Can I tell you what the width of the distribution is, or what the center of that distribution is? Okay, so yes, I agree absolutely with what you're saying, that there's already a distribution underlying here, and I've imposed another one. But I've imposed another one because we were going to need it to describe the physics. Yeah?
So the way I kind of understand it, like the neutrons in the center of this beam are going to see a different unitary than the on the edge.
Mm-hmm.
So we just need to integrate over that as well, right?
That's exactly right, that there's a distribution of unitaries throughout this process. And let me make a hierarchy here. So this particular map, of course, it could be unitary. We say, oh yeah, the system is just a simple rotation from input to output. It could have incoherence, and that is what we're describing here, is that there's a distribution of unitaries, okay? But there's here, notice, there's a one-to-one correspondent at every position z. I can define, don't need that, at every position z, I can define a unitary. And if that unitary is time independent, okay, then we would expect to see some complex dynamics, because we could come back and say, yes, if we do something again at that same position, we'll see the same effect. Okay, so this is called incoherence. Occasionally it's called dephasing. But the action of an incoherent process need not be a loss of phase. Okay, but in the literature you'll see it often as dephasing. And for this piece, we're saying, yep, we have a distribution of unitaries. We didn't need to invoke an environment. We could model it with an environment, but we didn't need to invoke one. And then, of course, there's decoherence, which is a loss of information. We really do need an environment to carry away the information. So here we have a loss of information. There's no real loss of information here. There's only an apparent loss of information. When we integrate at the end of the day with our helium-3 detectors, we lose this. Let me...
Sorry.
Yeah, please.
A classical distribution over the unitaries?
Yeah.
Then you're losing information there.
Thanks for the question. Let me show you an experiment. Let's take this beam coming in. And let me put a wedge here. I'm going to put a wedge of silica. Okay, and let's align it along the z-axis. So I didn't draw it that way, but pretend it's pointing out towards you. Okay? And so here, what's going to happen? Well, the thicker the material is, the bigger the phase shift will be, right? So that I can rewrite my phase shift. I can say, oh, well, I'll have a phase that looks like e to the I kz, 0, 0, and 1. And k is a wave number, right? It's just telling us, you're used to that, I hope. So k is 2 pi over some characteristic length. Yeah? Say no when it's no. Okay, so we have a spatially dependent phase shift here. Right? Yep. Okay. And now I say, what will I see here if I look at it with the helium-3 detector, which is integrating, which is doing exactly this? Then I'll see that I lose the phase, right? And since I'm integrating over a beam, I'll lose it as a sync function, right? So if I said, well, what is the contrast? The contrast would fall like so. It would actually fall as a square of that, so I should be careful. It would fall off as 1 over k. So I don't draw it very well. Now, instead of putting a helium-3 detector here, I could put a position-sensitive detector. What I could do is I could take a CCD. So we take a CCD camera, lots of little elements. They detect photons, right? And on top of this, I can put a thin layer of a scintillator. That's easy, boron. Boron detects neutrons, gives off a little flash of light. So we'll put boron here. Boron 10. Exactly the same reason they're flooding the reactors with boron, right? It absorbs. And so every time we get a neutron coming in, there'll be a flash of light and it will excite some range of those detector elements. What do I see now?
You don't
average
over
Z. Say it again?
You don't average over Z anymore.
That's right. So what do I see in terms of an intensity? You know, it's a two-dimensional detector. What do I see in terms of the intensity for that wedge?
Okay.
So I see what?
I'll see a series of stripes. I'll see a modulation pattern as I look over this. And this periodicity will exactly be 2 pi over k. Okay, and so if I look at it integrated with the helium 3 detector, it appears that I've lost contrast. It appears exactly as you say, that I've lost information. But I lost the information in the way I carried out the measurement. The information was actually still sitting there in the underlying neutron distribution until I did this other measurement. And if I use a position sensitive detector, so now I make a measurement that's conditioned on Z, right? Then I recover the contrast, because for every location in Z, it was only a unitary to begin with. Okay? And so we get this nice 1 plus cosine kz divided by 2 dependence on the detector. And of course, if I integrate over this, I get exactly 1/2. And so I lose all of the interesting physics. Yeah? So we'll look at this a little bit more. But the point that I want to make sure you've caught is that for this piece, we can describe, and we need to describe, physics that varies over some classical probability distribution. Okay? And although it's often neglected in descriptions of physics experiments, it is usually the biggest term there. And it really does change how we model things. Because if you're saying that there's an underlying distribution that retains information, and you're looking at the information flow through your process, your conclusion depends upon how you characterize the underlying probabilities. Yeah? Okay. So, now this piece we know how to do. This piece we can do right there. We still need to add decoherence into the system. We still need to say that there's a loss of information which isn't going to be modeled by saying that the elements of the distribution undergo different processes. There's a piece of information that says information is purely lost. Yeah? And I want to describe that for you as well. And here we're going to describe this again in terms of Krauss operators. And I want you to connect the Krauss picture to the Bloch sphere picture. Okay, so you know that in the 50s, Bloch and Purcell shared the Nobel Prize for discovering magnetic resonance. And Bloch, you know of because of Bloch's wave function, that he was very important in the development of quantum mechanics. Purcell, you know of because of his textbook in electricity and magnetism. And when they published their papers back to back, they were both at MIT during World War II, so they worked together. Then, of course, Purcell went to Harvard and Bloch went to Stanford. And Bloch, who's the at the foundation of quantum mechanics, publishes a paper with a classical picture of magnetic resonance. And Purcell publishes a paper with a quantum mechanical picture of magnetic resonance. And it's often taken that Bloch publishes his paper just to get the phenomenology right. But you have to read his two papers. What he does is he shows that, in fact, there's an isomorphism between SU2 and O3. and that the classical picture is complete. So it wasn't that Bloch didn't know the quantum picture. In fact, he understood it in full description. But he understood it so well that he realized that there was a more compact classical picture that is only true, of course, in SU2, that covers all the dynamics. There's nothing missing. And so it's useful to make those connections.
So isomorphism is between
SU2
and? O3. O3, I see.
Okay, so now then, we start off by saying that we have some Hamiltonian because we need to define an energy. We're working in SU2, so we just choose a direction. And everyone chooses the z-axis. Bloch got the first choice, and no one has a right to say it should be x now. He said z, it's z. So this says that the z-axis is unique. The projection of the qubit along the z-axis is going to define the energy of the system. Okay, and it doesn't matter what the phase is in the xy plane, that there's no energy associated with any difference in phase. Right? They're done. And then we need to say that there's a probability that noise enters into the system. And so in addition to this, we define two Krauss operators. The biggest one says that nothing happens. Okay? The biggest one says that the only thing that happens is the system evolves according to the so-called Zeeman interaction. And the smaller one says that there's a spin flip. Okay, so now we could take and say, well, why is a spin flip? I could easily add another spin in the environment that's going to flip with this one. So imagine that this is the most common mechanism for these processes, that I have my qubit here of interest. And somewhere in the environment, I have a dipolar coupled qubit as well. And this one's down, this one's up, and they both flip. Okay? And of course, I have many more examples in the environment. The environment exchanges energy with each other. And because there's this exchange process between the system and the environment, if I leave it long enough, the system will come to the temperature of the environment. Yeah?
What does it say? E to the power of what?
In the cover? G over T1.
T over T1.
So I've defined a rate in terms of T1. And you don't normally see it like this, but this is the nicest way of defining it, because that for any value of T, you get the correct Krauss operators. And of course, it's trivial for you to show that you have the correct normalization for these. And directly, we can see that we have an effective probability, which is the square of these, and an action. Okay, a spin flip or nothing. Yeah? Now, of course, what we would like to do is then to go and ask what happens in an infinitesimal picture, right? And so then we can ask what happens when T is short. Yeah? And I wonder if I should do this now, given that we only have a few more minutes. Well, let me outline it for you, and I'm going to lose that definition. And let me just look at it in terms of a short time. Okay? I'm not going to... No.
If you expand the exponential in the first one,
yeah.
The one cancels, or
yeah, I'll end up with. Oh, you know, I mean it the other way around. Actually, in the first
in
one.
In the first one, okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Now this is correct. Yeah, that's exactly right. It has to be e to the minus t over t1 in the first one, and 1 minus that, etc. I should look at my notes occasionally when I lecture. Okay. So now then, let's ask about the evolution of this system. Then we could say, well, what happens? We know that if I have a state rho of dt, then rho of dt is going to evolve. I'm going to drop this Hamiltonian for a while. I'm going to just look at the Krauss operators. We'll come back and look at what happens with the Hamiltonian. Then it says, okay, I get this term that looks like 1 minus t dt over t1, the identity, rho identity. Okay, and I get a term here that looks like plus t over t1, sigma x rho sigma x. And this should be dt as well. Thank you. And then I'm going to take this piece, okay, which says that rho of dt is equal to rho at time 0, right, and say, that's so easy. So d rho divided by dt is equal to 1 over t1 sigma x minus minus rho. Yeah? And now Bloch's equations. Bloch's equations tells us how the system evolves. It says that d expectation value sigma x dt is equal to. And so you can see if I substitute in sigma x here, then I get sigma x minus that says that there's no evolution. D sigma x dt is equal to 0. Right? And d sigma y dt is equal to, here we would have sigma y sigma x sigma y is I sigma z sigma x is I sigma y, so it's minus sigma y, so minus twice, so this will be 2 sigma y over t1. Yeah, and d sigma z dt is 2 sigma z over t1. Right? So we've introduced one noise in the system. That is just a spin flip. We've introduced it with a particular weighting. Okay. And it leads to a set of couple differential equations, which if you like, you could talk about as a Lindblad equation, but here just treat them as Bloch's equations. Yeah.
So Bloch wanted to derive the classical, so shouldn't there be expectation values in this equation?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Now, of course, this isn't the end of the story. That here we see that the z component relaxes in this model with T1 over 2. And the x and y have this strange asymmetry, which will not survive the evolution of the internal Hamiltonian. Remember that this is the fastest process. Okay, so now then I have to say, oh, I want to ask what actually happens in the case where I have the dynamics of this process occurring. So I need to reintroduce an interaction frame based upon this term, which is going to mix these two, right? A rotation about z is going to mix x and y. And so in the correct final result, this goes into this goes into there's a negative sign. All of these have a negative sign. Sorry. That one, of course, remains as it was. Okay. So now that we can see that yes, we have a piece which in this case looks depolarizing. It looks like it's going to reduce the length of the Bloch sphere. It has, in Bloch's equations, he takes and defines a second parameter, T2, to account for the difference in the rate of relaxation for the energy-dependent and the non-energy-dependent relaxation. And the reason for that is, again, you'll see it in the notes, it's because there are more contributions to the non-energy term than there are to the energy term. If I want to have an energy relaxation, I want the spin to flip from up to down, it has to have that amount of energy. And so there needs to be something in the environment which is going to be a fluctuating field that can give up the right amount of energy. Whereas in the dephasing, it doesn't cost us energy to rotate the system. So anything can allow for a dephasing operation. Okay, so there are many more contributions. You see that again in the notes. Now, let me quickly get that file up here and then show it to you, and then we'll bloody hell. Okay, so I'm looking at, and you're not looking at, the Mathematica notebook for the second lecture. And someday you'll get to see it too. Good. All I do is to define the internal Hamiltonian, just as we did. I go through and define for you equilibrium states. That's not so important here. But then we go through and define the super operator. And so have a look at that. That's the same thing as the Krauss representation of those. And then we go through various models of noise in the systems. This is, in particular, is an additional contribution to dephasing noise. So noise about the z-axis. And there's lots of these models. And then you can look at what the super operators tell us. So this 4x4 matrix now is in Liouville space, describing the evolution of the operators in Hilbert space. And it's indexed in this case for identity x, y, and z. And the particular model that we're applying here is a dephasing model, which is noise about the z-axis. And so you can see that as you would expect, the model shows you that there's an attenuation of the x and y components, and there's no attenuation of the z component. If you add to that unitary evolution about the x and y, right, the superoperator is a complete picture of the dynamics, so we can add any sort of dynamics there. We see that the x and y operators are mixed with each other, and the z operator, of course, remains unchanged. I won't go through all of these because there's too many, and you can look at them yourself. It's easy enough to calculate the dynamics. So here we just plot out the expectation values of the various operators. And when you look at the literature in atomic and molecular physics, you'll often find statements that say T1 is equal to twice T2 or T1 is equal to T2. And they're given really crisply that this is the answer. And it depends entirely on the model. So here, I'll give you the models and so you can know when that stuff is true and when it's not true. Now, there's one other file that you should pay attention to. I didn't even open it recently. And here's what I want. And here, what we do is describe the Troy matrix for any arbitrary map. And we reduce the Troy matrix to the Krauss operators. The Krauss operators are the eigenvectors of the Troy map, okay, and the weights, the probabilities are the corresponding eigenvalues. And this is an extremely useful picture to have in your mind for these things. So have a look at that tool. And there's one last piece that I really do want to show you. Stop. So we have rho of z and some set of parameters. You know, it might be the T1 and T2. It could be some Hamiltonian. Whatever it is, we, you know, some set of unitaries as a function of z, of course, of time. Whatever it is, something in our model. This is our model of the system. And when we have this, we can always go and define a superoperator. The superoperator says, what is the map of that dynamics at one instant in time? Remember, the superoperator is telling us about the effective map over some action. Okay? So this says, yes, for these sets of parameters, I can define this. Now, of course, I can also define for this a set of Krauss operators depending upon whether this is completely positive or not. If it's completely positive, then we can define a set of Krauss operators. And from the Krauss operator picture, it's, of course, easy to calculate the superoperator. We just integrate the thing, sum over them. And the Troy matrix allows us to go back to that. But nothing in this picture allows us to go back to this. Okay, there's more information here than there is in all of this. So these are compact representations that are incredibly useful and often are what you have accessible to you at the end of an experiment. But this is the piece that has the complete physics. Right? These are only talking about the resultant apparent physics. Okay? So, yeah.
Which, either one.
You said before that Choi allows you to order the actions.
Yes.
Is that like a minus
function? That's right. So the since you get out the eigenvalues of this, it gives you a compact representation, and the eigenvalues in the, you know, the simplest picture that I gave you give you the probabilities.
So I just want to mention that for Thurs's tutorial,
yeah,
I've written a little appendix on the how the super operator is related to the Krauss picture, because they've seen Krauss operators, but they haven't really seen the super operator, which involved vectorization and stuff.
Right.
So, you know, they can play with your Mathematica notebook and learn from that too.
Yeah.
But if they want to, if any of you want a more formal definition, just to get a picture of, you know, how it's done mathematically.
That's really good, because you already will have seen from me that if you want any formalisms, I'm the wrong person to come to. But at the start of this piece, somewhere up here, we do give you the vectorized picture of the density matrix, and of course discuss the operator picture, the Louisville operator picture, the super operator. So it's in there, but nothing formal. And it's great. Okay, so we'll stop here. We'll continue. So what we'll do is, next class, we're going to take these tools, we're going to apply them to neutron interferometer. Okay, so it'll all become clear then that we'll look at what the noise really is in neutron interferometer and how we're going to account for that in our model. And then we'll build up the model and we'll ask you, again, the same question we asked you last time, is given the realities, the physical realities of this model, what can you actually prove with neutron interferometry about quantum mechanics? Right, that's for you to tell me.